Raised voices can be heard as I approach the door, but this time I resist the urge to eavesdrop. I knock stoutly. After a series of rattles and chunks, it opens a fraction. Paul's beleaguered face falls further when he sees me.
Oh, God, you again. I told you I was sorry. Can't you just leave me alone?
Wait, I jam my foot in the door. I need to talk to you.
There's nothing to talk about.
Just for a minute, please. You owe me that much. He begins to speak, then relents.
Okay, come on.
Clitzia is by the refrigerator, brandishing, for reasons I do not inquire into, a frying pan. The air is decidedly fraught, and a repetitive croaking issues from the next room. I hope I am not interrupting.
I haven't interrupted anything, Claude. Just enjoying a peaceful, non-violent breakfast here with my totally functional family. Can I get you something? A coffee, maybe? Clitzia, would you mind fixing our guest a coffee?
We don't have coffee, she says.
Well, how about tea, then? Tea all right with you, Claude?
Whatever is convenient, I say.
No tea either, Clitzia says.
Her accent makes everything she says sound contemptuous, as if every statement were preceded by a long pull on a cigarette and a defiant billow of smoke. Paul half turns in his chair.
We don't have tea or coffee.
You want me to steal some? She says.
A glass of water would be perfect, I say. Remington wanders through the bedroom door, burping. Paul pours a glass of brownish water and plonks it down in front of me.
It tastes a bit strange, but we think it's basically okay.
He says.
Okay, so what do you want to talk to me about? Remington, for God's sake, stop burping.
It's my birthday!
That's incredibly annoying, Paul says. Sorry, Claude, go on.
I want to ask you about Ariadne.
The waitress. What about her?
I tell him about our conversation in the cafe yesterday. It's strangely pregnant undertone.
Okay,
he says.
But what's that got to do with me?
That time in the Ark, you said she would be the perfect love interest for the everyman.
Yes?
So I want to know what happens next.
Next?
In the story. Paul looks mystified.
I don't understand what you're getting at,
he says. What I'm getting at is I have somehow found myself in the plot of your novel, and I want to know what I should do.
You're asking me for love advice, is that it?
I'm asking what you think will happen next in the novel of The Everyman.
There is no novel,
he says with a touch of desperation.
We've been through this.
What if I ask you to write it? I say. There is a long silence. Even Remington stops his burping.
Is this some kind of joke?
Paul says. No joke. When we spoke in the cafe, you told me my life lacked a story. Obviously, you had your own agenda. Nevertheless, you were right. What I am asking you now is to write that story. He glances back at his wife as if to assure himself he isn't dreaming. Leaned against the fridge, Clitzia stares down at me impassively. In the morning light, the apartment's veneer of opulence is thinner, and I can see signs of decay all around, drawers all over their runners, nails poking jaggedly from floorboards, a long silver split in the obsidian countertop. Paul gets up, backs away to the sink, looks at the floor.
I'm very flattered that you should ask me,
he says slowly.
But I don't write books anymore, I told you that.
I'm not talking about a book. I take a sip of brackish water, lean forward on my chair. You said that what the everyman needed was a love story. Now I want you to help me plot that story.
In real life?
In real life. Move the narrative forward, create scenes, maybe some dialogue. Essentially nothing different from what you have done before, only that instead of putting my life into your book, you would, so to speak, put your book into my life. Remington burps thoughtfully. Paul pulls his hands through his hair and down his face, as if I have set him some fiendish mathematical problem.
Claude, look. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but that is a really fucking weird idea.
It's unusual, I agree. But it is quite rational. When we want medical advice, we go to our doctor. When we want financial advice, we speak to our broker. We are happy to delegate many areas of our lives to people better qualified. Why should relationships be any different? When we fall in love, why not have a specialist to advise us? Someone who understands human nature, who can help us to express the right feelings.
Pff, he's crazy talk, Glitzia says.
Of course, I would be willing to pay whatever you feel such a service merited, I add.
Not interested, Glitzia says.
Hold on, Paul intervenes.
Didn't you hear him? He says he's going to pay.
It will never work, she says. No one falls in love with a disguise.
On the contrary, I say, people fall in love with disguises all the time.
And what happens when this woman finds out truth? You want this man make you scripts for the rest of your life? He's not even any longer a writer.
Well, hold on a second, Paul objects. I can write if I want. If someone's going to pay me, then I'll write.
How you have not written word in 7 years?
Look, would you please just... Jesus, Remington, what are you doing to that rug?
I want to see if the grey bits taste different from the blue bits.
With a gurgle of exasperation, his father picks him up and carries him to the sink, where he begins wiping fluff from his tongue.
If you want to become closer to this woman, you bring her a nice bunch of flowers, Clitzia says to me. Not idiot conspiracy.
It's his money, isn't it?
He can do what he wants with it.
Paul says over his shoulder,
Look, this is impossible. Come on, Claude, let's go somewhere we can talk about this in peace.
Wait.
With a swift sidestep, Clitzia blocks his passage.
Bring the boy.
But we're trying to have a meeting.
He needs fresh air.
Clitzia, the whole reason we're going somewhere else is that neither of you will be there.
Clitzia folds her arms.
Can we go to the park, Dad?
Remington tugs his sleeve.
Can we feed the ducks?
Oh, Christ.
Paul says.
Sorry about this, Claude.
Not at all,
I say. The park is a perfectly good place for a meeting. Remington runs to the fridge and comes back with a bag which he presents to his father. Paul looks displeased.
We have no tea or coffee, but we got a whole loaf of stale bread,
he says.
We've nothing for the humans but a fridge full of food for the ducks.
Clitzia chooses not to hear this. Scowling, Paul puts Remington's coat on and leads us out to the hall.
Let me give you a piece of advice, Claude,
he says, pulling the door closed.
Never marry a lap dancer.
Right, I say uncertainly and follow them down the dimly lit corridor. The lift is still broken, and on the landing, the plastic sheeting that covers the portal to the unfinished wing whispers and sways. Are there other people living here? I ask.
That depends what you mean by living,
he says, starting down the stairs.
And by people.
Oh, I say.
Ours is the only apartment that actually managed to sell. We bought it off the plans.
He laughs.
That was the boom for you. A first-time novelist and an ex-stripper could get $500,000 from the bank for an apartment that didn't exist yet. Now we're in so much negative equity, we'll probably be stuck here for the rest of our lives.
It's a nice apartment.
It's a classic Celtic tiger piece of shit. There's a jacuzzi, but the water's brown. There's a heated tail rail in every room, but the radiators don't work. That's not the worst of it either.
He pushes through a heavy metal door to a vast, inky space. At first, I have the bizarre notion that we are underwater. Then, in the distance, I spy a car.
Look at that!
He points to the wall. A long, ragged crack stretches all the way from the ground to the ceiling.
And there's another one, on that side. And another one there!
What happened? It looks as if there has been an earthquake.
Pyrite. In the walls, in the foundations, it expands when it gets wet. They might as well have built the place with icing sugar.
So, I frown, not wanting to draw the obvious conclusion.
The whole building's worthless. Totally worthless. 10 years or so, it'll probably fall down with us in it. Until then, of course, the bank still wants its mortgage repayments.
Dad, can I have the keys?
Remington runs off to a point right in the centre of the grey morass, where he raises his arm stiffly like an orchestra conductor. In its corner, the car bleeps and flashes obediently. He scurries over to it and opens the door.
There's nothing you can do?
Not much. The builder's gone bust. The insurance say they're not liable. We don't have the money to bring it to court.
He climbs into the car. Remington has already belted himself in at the back.
It could be worse,
he says.
As a former novelist, I do get some enjoyment out of living in a giant metaphor. Pyrite. Fool's fucking gold. If you put it in a book, no one would believe it.
He starts the engine. We pull out into the wan sunshine. The neighbourhood doesn't look much better by day. A new selection of garbage lines the footpath. The street is deserted, but in the heavily graffitied playground, a succession of cadaverous figures shuffles up to a man in a leather jacket, while a solitary child amuses itself on the broken merry-go-round.
Dad, how many ducks are there in the park?
26.
Do you think there was ever a boy who had a pet duck and he kept it in his bedroom?
No, I don't think there was.
He cranes his head around. Now, Daddy and Claude have important things to talk about, so I want you to play at being quiet, okay?
Okay. Dad?
Yes?
Who would win a battle between Aslan and a dinosaur?
Aslan would win.
Even if the dinosaur was really big?
Yes.
Even if he was bigger than the universe?
Is this you being quiet?
Oh yeah.
Remington remembers. The car noses onto a bridge. The river glints sullenly below us.
So your wife, I say.
What about her?
I want to ask him about what he said in the hallway about marrying a lap dancer, but can't quite summon the courage. She is from Eastern Europe?
That's right. Little place called Ectovia. It used to be part of Mactovia. Then when Transvolga seceded from Ectovia, it became a sub-district of Transvolga. Then it seceded from Transvolga to become the Ectovian Free Democratic Republic, though free is a bit of a stretch. They've had the same president for the last 15 years. He used to be a carpet salesman. In fact, he sold us the rug in the living room, the one Remington was licking. I don't know if you saw it.
And how did she come to be in Ireland?
Well, the Ectovian economy's been in a bad way for a long time now. No jobs, no money, young people queuing up to leave. Clitzia was one of the lucky ones. She was recruited to come here and work as a waitress. But then when she arrived, she found out she'd actually been contracted to a lap dancing club. She couldn't get out of it till she'd paid off the people who'd brought her over.
And is that how you met?
He laughs. I'm afraid so. I was out celebrating my book deal with some friends. Velvet Dreams is where we ended up. My friends got me a lap dance with Clitzia as a joke. You can't imagine how embarrassed I was. This woman who looked like she'd just come down from Mount Olympus, and she's stuck in this little cubicle with me doing this ridiculous... Anyway, I was so nervous I started jabbering away to her about my book. And then she, who's standing there in her underwear, starts telling me about Dostoevsky and the dialogic imagination. I didn't even know what the dialogic imagination was. I still don't. But by the time I left the cubicle, I was head over heels in love with her.
We come off the bridge and nose our way slowly along the quay in the opposite direction to the river.
In Ectovia, they take literature very seriously. That's what I found out later. They used to have a special firing squad just for novelists.
And does she still work there in Velvet Dreams?
Thinking this might explain my bizarre encounter with him last week.
No, she hasn't done that stuff for a long time. A couple of weeks after I met her, I bought her out of a contract. Took half my advance, probably the most romantic thing I've ever done.
He pauses and then says,
I'm not sure she ever forgave me.
I study his face, but in profile it's hard to read his expression.
She works as a cleaner now.
He continues.
Offices, private residences.
Does she like it?
Like it.
He turns to me as we pull up at a traffic light.
Getting up at 5 a.m. to clean toilets for minimum wage.
Sorry, silly question.
Clitzia's got 2 degrees, Claude. She's read more books than anyone I've ever met.
Sorry.
The light turns green. To the left, the tanks and towers and the vats of the Guinness factory loom zanily over a high stone wall, like something from an alcoholic fairy tale.
It could be worse, he says. At least as a cleaner, she doesn't have people looking at her. She's basically paid to be invisible, although not as nearly as much as she got paid for taking her clothes off.
And you?
Me what?
You are working too?
Well, I have a few irons in the fire.
A book?
He wags his head.
That ship has sailed. Maybe in a country like Clitsia's, where they've only got 3 hours of electricity a day, you can still make a living writing books. Here people don't want them anymore. They've got other things. Phones, games, porn, horse tranquilizers. I'm not complaining, I'm just saying these are the market realities.
And it is these market realities that persuaded you to stop writing? I say?
Pretty much.
It was not, for example, because of the review?
What review?
His head snaps round.
The Mary Cutlass review of For Love of a Clown?
Oh, that,
he says. His tone is indifferent, but his face has turned the colour of a London bus.
I didn't pay much attention to it.
Really?
All that woman likes to read about is genocide,
he says.
The Holocaust, Rwanda, Cambodia, Srebrenica. If you're writing about some soul-harrowing nadir of human depravity, you get a big gold star. My book is about a girl who falls in love with a clown. How could she not hate it? It was like sending a dog to review cats.
He still hasn't explained what he meant by irons in the fire, but before I can ask him, an enormous peal of thunder shakes the sky. A moment later, water sluices down with a kind of exultancy.
Dad, it's raining!
I can see that.
Are we going home?
No, we're not.
Signalling right, he brings us back over the river and up through an imposing gate. On either side of a long avenue behind cascading veils of rain, the park materializes as a damp shimmer of colours, viridian, jade, ochre and crimson bleeding into one another and pulsating weakly as if through static.
A duck!
Remington cries. He is right. Between a pond and a bed of rose bushes stands a lone mallard, his motionless beak pointed proudly skywards. The car pulls up. Grabbing his bread, Remington makes a bid for the door. His father yanks him back by the hood of his coat.
It's pouring rain. What's your mother going to say if I bring you home soaking wet?
We could tell her I fell into the pond,
Remington says hopefully.
We'll just have to wait till it stops,
Paul says. As he speaks, another peal of thunder cracks through the sky.
Jesus Christ!
Remington says in the back seat.
Remington?
I'm just saying what you say,
Remington replies innocently. Paul mumbles darkly to himself.
Christ, what a country!
Remington says.
That's enough!
Jesus fucking Christ, this fucking country!
Okay, look. Paul unbuckles his seatbelt, then opens the door to extricate Remington. Try and find a dry part to play in, will you? With an exclamation of pure joy, Remington tears away across the grass, throwing fistfuls of bread at the surprised duck. He's a very energetic little boy, I say.
He certainly is.
Remington, I repeat. Is that a family name, on from your wife's homeland, perhaps?
Not exactly, Claude,
he replies with false pleasantness.
Tell me. Have you ever heard of a TV detective called Remington Cocksmoking Steel?
Of course, although in France he's just called Remington Steel.
Well, it turns out that in a certain corner of the former Soviet Union, old Remington Steel is still very popular. In fact, it's the number one show over there, bigger even than Celebrity Gulag and Top 10 Interrogation Bloopers. I thought it was a ludicrous name for a boy, but I was overruled.
Out on the lawn, the duck has escaped. Remington entertains himself by running around in long, uneven ellipses, making quacking noises. He seems not to notice the rain. Looking out at him, Paul folds his hands atop the steering wheel.
Okay, Claude, this proposal of yours, I'm presuming it's some kind of revenge, right? Some kind of sting or hidden camera type deal where you can show my web of lies to the world.
No, I say, disconcerted. It is just as I said to you in the apartment. I have developed feelings for Ariadne, but it's been a long time since I've had any kind of relationship, and I fear that, As you said, there is not enough of me showing up on the page.
So you want me to help you?
That's right.
You want me to rewrite your character so it'll click with this girl in the cafe like Pretty Woman or something?
Yes, or Cyrano de Bergerac. You have diagnosed very accurately the emptiness of my life. Now I want you to help me to fill it.
He puffs out his cheeks, watches a busload of ponchoed tourists alight into the rain.
You don't like it? You think it is an impossible idea?
It's not that I don't like it,
he says.
Frankly, I'm so broke that if you're proposing I dress up as your nanny and spank you, I'd give it serious consideration. But I don't get it. You're not a bad-looking guy, you have a ton of money, you've got your whole French thing going on. What do you need me for? There must be a lot of women out there just dying to jump in the sack with you.
They are all the wrong women.
And Ariadne, who you barely know, you're certain is the right woman.
Yes, but I don't think she will be impressed by my money or my Frenchness.
It's always the one you can't have, eh?
I don't know. It is this time.
And why ask me?
I liked your novel. It seems to me that it too is a story of opposites attracting.
Okay, sure, but the fact remains I tried to rip you off, Claude. Why would you trust me after that?
I consider this. Your plan was very stupid, yet your intuitions were strong. First, to pick me out as the subject for your scam, to find someone, as you say, who feels something is missing from his life and so can be manipulated. The next thing, you discover Ariadne. From all the women you could have chosen, you find exactly the one I will fall in love with.
I picked her out because she happened to be in my line of vision. If it had been the blonde one, I would have said her.
I disagree. These split-second decisions are a matter of pure instinct. It's the same thing that makes the great traitor. He can see the story before anyone else. Not all of it, just the first lines, the edges, as they are coming out of the future. But that is enough!
Paul does not react to this, just continues to gaze at the shifting silver-gray mosaic of the rain on the windscreen.
You don't have to literally write the words in my mouth, I tell him. What I want is a consultant, someone who understands this world of the heart that has become foreign to me and can advise me what to do. If you agree, then I propose to pay you.
I name a sum. I feel it is generous, but he seems unmoved. I don't understand.
There is no downside here. Even if you think it is a waste of time, you'll still get paid.
It isn't exactly writing, but at the very least it'll pay for you to reclaim your desk from the pawn shop.
At the mention of the desk, he flinches. But before he can speak, there comes a cry from outside. From the top of an incline, Remington is shouting that he has found something. His father rolls down the window.
What is it?
I found an ant!
The boy shrieks.
Look! Dad, look!
He hurtles down the hill and over to the car, holding out his cupped hands. A tiny black shape scurries back and forth over the pink dunes of his palms, antennae flailing, all its landmarks stripped away in an instant. I feel a surge of pity and recognition.
Can I keep him, Dad?
What do you want an ant for?
To be my friend!
I don't know if we got room in the apartment for pets.
Please!
All right. Now shake off some of that water. We're going home.
Where will I put my aunt?
I don't know. Stick him in your pocket.
I have a box, I interject hastily and dig around in my coat. Emptying out a heap of breath mints, I present the plastic case to Remington, who tips the bewildered aunt inside. Paul gets out to put the boy into his seat, then climbs back into his own. But he doesn't start the engine. He just sits there, contemplating the rain. Then, at last, he turns to me.
I'll do it,
he says.
But it'll cost you.
The figure he names is double what I proposed. His audacity makes me laugh. Maybe you should be working for BOT.
Maybe I shouldn't have gotten €500,000 worth of debt,
he says without smiling.
Then I wouldn't have had to start thinking like a banker.
I think I'll call him Roland.
Remington says, dangling the breath mints box before his nose in the back seat.
Sit, Roland! Stay, Roland! Play dead, Roland!
What kind of a name is Roland for an ant?
Paula objects.
Think of something else.
Roland?
Remington says. Paul turns around in his seat.
Jesus Christ, Remington, the name you just thought of was Roland.
What's a good name for an aunt, Dad?
Paul thinks for a minute.
Anthony,
he says. Remington and I are forced to concede that this is a good name.
See, that's what you're paying for,
Paul says. I mean to keep it to myself, but I am so excited that in a moment of weakness, I let slip to Ish that I have engaged the writer's services. She is not impressed. I can't believe you're even talking to that slime ball, she says.
There didn't seem any point in holding a grudge, I say. After all, he didn't actually do anything.
He did plenty, Ish says. Imagine if his plan had come off. Where would we be then?
Now I have seen how he lives, I can understand it a lot better, I tell her. He has a young family, he's deeply in debt. He bought an apartment during the boom that is now worth a fraction of its original price.
Join the club, Ish comments mordantly.
He stopped writing.
Completely.
This takes her by surprise. He hasn't written anything for 7 years.
So what does he do all day?
Nothing. Drinks, goes to strip clubs.
So you're going to give him another crack at robbing the bank, is that it?
I don't answer. Ariadne has arrived with our orders. She smiles at me as she sets down the plate. I smile back at her.
Claude?
Ah, yes, so...
Without mentioning Ariadne, I give Ish the barest sketch of the plan, the idea of continuing the next months of my life as if they were in a book.
What's the point of that?
She says.
I suppose it's a kind of life coaching, embracing the moment, that kind of thing. Discovering my humanity.
That Chancellor, what does he know about humanity? When's the last time anyone saw his blimmin' humanity?
Well, this is only a pretext. I say my real hope is that if I ask him to create the scenarios for me, after a while he may be inspired actually to write the book.
The book about the bank in every man?
That book, any book. It seems to me that if he has a regular income, maybe he will no longer feel so disillusioned. He will remember he is happier as a working writer than as an unemployed con man. That is my, what do you say, ulterior motive.
Be careful, Claude, she says gloomily. You can't try to change someone. My online psychic's always telling me that. She chomps down on a stick of celery. Are we going to be in these, what do you call, scenarios as well? I think I will keep him away from the bank this time, to avoid any temptation, you know.
Probably right,
Ish agrees. She crunches her food morosely for a moment, then says,
the more I think about it, the more I wondered if I wanted to be in the book anyway. You know, what if I turned out to be one of those characters nobody likes?
When they skip all the bits with me in them and they complain on Aperon about how boring I am.
You're not boring.
If he was going to put me in a book, I'd much prefer it was the me from a few years ago, when I was travelling with Tog, going to all those amazing places. She twirls the celery vacantly in the air, lost in some sad dream, then suddenly brightens.
I hear, though. Did I show you my necklace? My mum just sent it over.
She hooks the string with her finger, pulling it free of her neck so I can see it better. The necklace is composed of shells. They all appear white at first, but when I lean closer, I see that they are very subtly graded, running from blue to pink.
It's from Kokomoko.
Yeah, one of the tribal elders gave it to me. Here, I'll show you a picture. She takes her tablet from her bag and pulls up an image of an extremely wizened old woman.
Her name's Kavitatne. She's a king.
Not a queen?
No, she's a king from about 3 centuries ago, called Viri the Fierce.
I'm confused.
Well, like I was telling you, on the island, everything and everyone's all bound up together.
In the gifts?
Yeah, everything circulates, which means nobody really dies. Instead, all the ancestors are still floating around. They're in the gifts, they're on the fishing boat, they're at the feasts, and whenever there's an important decision to be made, the dead kings speak through their chosen mouthpiece.
So your friend here is possessed by this King Viri?
Well, she channels him. It's quite funny when you've got some bigwig from Shell or whatever coming over wanting to talk about mining rights,
and they find themselves having to make their presentation to the ghost of a king in the body of an old lady.
There are more pictures, semi-naked people in coracles or daubed in spirals brandishing spears. I make appreciative noises, all the while watching Ariadne from the corner of my eye as she circulates between the tables. Was Clitzia right? Is my plan insane? Many of my colleagues have attended weekend seminars on picking up women, the kind that advise you to begin by insulting whoever it is you want to sleep with. Others are signed up to internet dating services that promise perfect love without suffering by feeding your personal data into a computer to find your optimal match. Hiring a writer to mastermind my courtship does not seem significantly madder than these. And I wasn't lying to Ish. I do nourish hopes that I can coax Paul back into writing. If his debts didn't weigh so heavily, if he had time and space to think, why shouldn't his creativity flourish once more? In the meantime, however, there is work, where the mood is less buoyant. We have been holding out hope that Tordale will come back to us, but today on the news we see the former British Prime Minister being welcomed by the Caliph of Oran to his magnificent palace.
That's that, then, Ish says.
Kevin doesn't follow.
He's there with the UN, he says, setting up a ceasefire with the rebels.
That's just the cover story, Ish says. I explained that as soon as the Prime Minister left office, he had signed up as a consultant to one of the big three banks. That's the real reason he's in Oran.
What would a politician know about banking?
Kevin asks. He doesn't need to know anything, Ish says. His phone's got every head of state in it from the White House to Beijing. Think about it. You're a genocidal tyrant facing down 100,000 Islamic fundamentalists. Who do you want as your financial advisor? A bunch of nerds with four-color pie charts? Or the guy with a back door to every nuclear missile silo in the Western world? It's just business. These things happen all the time.All the news casts a pall of gloom over the whole office. Then, as if he has sensed from across the blue expanse of the Atlantic his acolytes losing faith...
Inspirational memo!
Kevin exclaims,
A new one!
Holy shit! Around the office, people jump up from their cubicles, jack-in-the-box fashion, the better to contemplate the message.
All that glitters is not gold, Ish reads.
What does it mean?
Kevin says.
Why is he telling us all that glitters is not gold?
It's a riddle, Ish decides.
Are you talking about the Blankley email?
Joe Peston from TTM says, coming in from the lobby.
Did you get it too?
Everybody got it.
What do you think it means?
Not sure, Joe says, rubbing his jaw. It seems to operate on a number of different levels.
I imagine it means all that glitters is not gold, I say. That is, be careful of overvalued stock.
What are we, four-year-olds? Joe says.
Everyone knows all that glitters isn't gold.
This guy's paid $28 million basic a year, Jocelyn Lockhart concurs from across the divider. He's not getting that just to send his staff proverbs. There's a, whatchamacallit, a subtext.
Maybe he wants us to short gold, Kevin suggests. Like, when he says all that glitters isn't gold, he means gold is overvalued.
The price of gold has risen for the last 6 months. Joe muses. Could be time for a correction. If he wanted us to short gold, wouldn't he just tell us to short gold, I say?
What kind of a riddle would that be?
Yeah, Claude, don't be stupid.
The memo says all that glitters is not gold, I point out. His issue is not with gold itself. He's talking about other misleadingly glittering substances. The others agree that this is a good point. But if all that glitters isn't gold, Jocelyn says slowly, raising a finger, then all that doesn't glitter isn't necessarily not gold, right? There is a silence as we struggle to establish whether this makes sense or not, and are still doing so when Jürgen clips in and tells us summarily that the minister's office has been in touch again about the Royal Irish report, and that they do not think they can wait till the end of the week. Ish and I look at each other. When do they want it?
Tomorrow,
Jürgen says.
Tomorrow? We boggle in unison.
What's the rush?
Kevin says.
Jürgen wiggles a finger in his ear.
My conjecture is that Royal Irish has run out of money again. If so, the minister will have to decide in the next few days whether to infuse yet more funds or whether the time has at last come for a wind down.
That's all very well, but how can we possibly get the report done by tomorrow? Ish says. Do they have any idea how much information there is to go through?
There is a series of black boxes within the accounts, I explain. I am beginning to think an anonymous investor has used them to build up holding in the bank. Either way, it is very hard to get a clear picture of its status.
Jürgen considers this.
But you have a general idea.
Oh, we've got a general idea, all right, Ish chimes in. It's fucked, that's the general idea.
My professional opinion would be that the bank is fucked, I concur.
They're facing litigation left and right, Ish goes on. Their collateral's going up in flames. Their brand has become an international byword for corporate malfeasance. There's literally no telling how much they owe. The minister can pour in as much money as he likes. It'll never be enough. They'll bleed him until there's nothing left.
And there is no positive spin we can put on this?
Jürgen says.
That is the positive spin, I say. Believe me, they don't want to see this report any sooner than they have to, Ish says.
What about the idea that the bank is of systemic importance, too big to fail?
Not true, I say.
The bank's business is all in one small sector, commercial property. If the government decides to wind it down, the losses will be contained.
And the creditors?
Will face significant write-downs, but they will be expecting that.
Jürgen stalls momentarily in that way he has, as if encountering a glitch in his coding. Then he nods assent.
Very good. Get as much done as you can before tomorrow. Rachel wants to see it before you sign off. And remember,
he says, pausing on his way back to the office,
keep all this information confidential until the report is published.
He turns to go and is almost knocked down by Gary McCrum, who comes barreling into the room in a state of extreme agitation.
He solved the riddle! He exclaims. He solved it and he's made a bloody fortune!
What? Who did?
Howie! It was so simple, so simple!
For what seems like a long time, he is too excited to tell us anything more. He just bounds around hooting like an ape that has won some banana lottery.
What's the safest bet for an investor?
He says when we manage to calm him down.
Better than gold, even.
He looks manically from one face to another.
T-bills, right?
T-bills?
Kevin says, curiosity overcoming embarrassment.
U.S. Treasury bonds, I tell him. Essentially, IOUs issued by the American government, they are regarded as practically risk-free.
Oh, right, I knew that, Kevin says.
What's that got to do with Howie?
Ish says.
Don't you see?
Gary exclaims, partially reverting to ape mode.
That's what Porter's email meant. T-bills are shakier than they look.
Howie bet against U.S. Treasury bonds. Joe Piston says, somewhat scandalized.
It was him and Grisha. Some crazy fucking rocket science deal using those weird antinomy things, but it came down to shorting T-bills. And then on the news... Wait, have you heard the news?
We turn on the TV, where the crawl tells us that a few minutes ago a Texan congressman, protesting government threats to take away the oil industry's billion-dollar subsidies, doused himself in gasoline in the House of Representatives and set himself on fire. A brief, almost unprocessable image flicks on screen, a writhing, suited silhouette at the center of a ball of incandescent light, while horrified figures with tans and elaborate hairstyles clamber around him powerlessly.
"The Texans are talking about seceding from the Union," Gary McCrum says happily. "The dollar sunk like a stone."
And not just the dollar. In the resulting turmoil, Dexter's, the ratings agency, has downgraded the investment rating of the world's safest security from AAA to AA. What the repercussions for the rest of the world will be, no one can tell. But for BOT, it means one very, very, very lucrative trade.
Betting against T-bills.
Joe Peston shakes his head in admiration.
Extremely counterintuitive,
Jürgen notes.
Essentially, Howie has combined two inspirational memos into one unstoppable super memo.
But how did Blankley know?
Kevin asks.
How did he know all this stuff was going to happen?
That's why they're paying him the big bucks, Gary says, clapping him on the shoulder.
Yeah,
Kevin says, turning towards the window and gazing up, as if Porter Blankley might be circling among the clouds out there like Superman. Official celebrations are scheduled for the following evening. Tonight, Kevin, Ish, and I are trapped in the office, laboring to finish the report on time. The sixth floor empties and the lights in the buildings around us wink out one by one. The inky near black of the sky only adds to the sense that we are literally submerged in Royal's accounts, a labyrinth of debt with some terrible wrongness at the center of it that at times I catch a glimpse of, but never for long enough to lay hold of.
He'll get the idea, Ish says, meaning the minister. No way he'll chuck any more money at them after reading this. Best thing at this stage be just to shove them off a cliff.
At 4 a.m., I mail the completed document to Rachel and Jürgen, then go back to my apartment to sleep for a couple of hours before returning to the office. Thankfully, the next day is relatively quiet, apart from a mid-morning meeting with Walter, most of which he spends complaining about the cost of port capacity in Belgium, where Dublex is shipping the cement they can no longer use in Ireland after the collapse of the construction industry. As I'm about to leave, I ask him whether he has money in Royal Irish. He stares at me for a moment, then says deliberately, "I have no holding in that bank." I tell him that's good news, as it's about to lose whatever minimal value it still has. He doesn't respond to this. He's hiding something. But then businessmen are always hiding something, particularly at this level, where the meticulous world of contracts and accounts and due diligence dissolves, and international commerce reveals itself to be an ethereal matter of nods, winks, unspoken understandings. As soon as evening falls, I set off for Paul's apartment to hear his initial plot outline. A commotion is issuing from inside. He answers the door as soon as I knock, his expression grave.
"Remington's aunt escaped,"
he tells me.
"Huh?" I say.
"Come on, come on,"
he says, chivying me over the threshold. "We don't want it getting out."
Obligingly, I step in.
"Stop!"
Paul shouts frantically, waving his arms and staring at my feet. I do as I am told, waiting on the spot for further instructions. The scene in the apartment is chaotic. Cupboard doors have been flung open, tins emptied, drawers pulled out, hideous Ectovian rugs overturned. Clitzia, dressed only in a towel, is on her hands and knees calling, "Roland, Roland!" into the darkness under the couch. The aunt's owner, meanwhile, is standing in the doorway opposite, a stubby, bellowing fountain of grief.
"It's the damnedest thing," Paul says, getting down on all fours. "That aunt lived like a king, a nice cozy breath mint box, a delicious sugar cube all to itself. Why would he run away?"
"I suppose a cage is a cage, no matter how opulent," I reflect.
"In retrospect, I may have made the air holes too big,"
Paul reflects.
"Well, I hope he's happy breaking a little boy's heart like that.
The poor kid's been crying for so long, I'm worried his body's going to run out of liquids.
Here, I'll go this way. Why don't you check in there?
The bathroom is clouded with fragrant Klitzia-inflected steam, which makes it both hard to see anything and rather disconcertingly intimate. The small space is dominated by a jacuzzi, black and gargantuan, like a hippopotamus backed into a broom closet. Cluttering the damp rim are tubes of creams and lotions, many with the ends cut off so the remnants can be scraped out. A toilet, also black, looms menacingly out of the mist. I cannot see any ants, but reaching for the door handle, I find myself grasping instead a pair of knickers that hang from it. They are sheer and stringy, almost to the point of dissolving in my hand. I feel embarrassed, even being in the same room as them, and hurry out again, only to discover the way back blocked by Klitzia, her toweled rear pointing up to me and her nose pressed to the floorboards in the manner of some impossibly sexual aardvark.
"I'll just take a look in here,"
I say in a high voice and push through the door on my left. I am in the master bedroom. It features the same Babylonian trappings as the rest of the apartment, velour drapes, gilt sconces, ornate architrave, but here they are almost invisible because everywhere I look there are books stacked double on shelves, crammed into cases, piled in towers that reach almost to the ceiling, resembling nothing so much as the wall of a child's fort, a meticulously constructed and intrinsically doomed attempt to keep the world at bay. A laptop sits on a desk by the window, the manufacturer's logo rotating and distending anamorphically. I regard it with a certain degree of temptation, wondering whether my story may already be taking shape in there. Then I notice something on the desk itself. A numbered sticker in the corner. This must be the writing desk that Klitzia pawned.
Paul has redeemed it. My heart leaps. For why would he do that unless he intended to write?
The thought that my plan for him is already having an effect gives me high hopes for his plan for me. I look again at the laptop. Surely, under the circumstances, it wouldn't be wrong to have a very quick glance at what he's doing. Given that I'm providing the material and the financing, just a peep, a sneak preview is...
Oh, God!
Reeling back from the computer, I slip on a paperback and fall backwards onto the floor. A tower of books pounces gleefully on top of me.
"Research! Research!" cries Paul, running in from the next room and diving between me and the computer screen, although the image has already seared itself indelibly into my brain.
"That's a separate matter I've been looking into," he tells me, clearing falling books from my chest. "For a potential..."
"Hey! What's going on in there?"
Klitzia yells from the next room.
"I found him!"
Paul calls, crouching down in the corner.
"You found him!"
Remington comes rushing in with Klitzia behind him. She levels a single reductive glance at me, still prone on the floor, then looks away.
"See for yourself!"
Paul rises to his feet and opens his cupped hands.
"Look, Remington! Who do we have here?"
Remington glances down into his hands and snuffles.
"I don't know."
"Well, it's Roland, see? Look, he's waving his little leg at you. Hi, Remington."
"That isn't him."
"What do you mean? Who else would it be?"
"A different ant."
"It's not a different ant. Take a listen.
Roland, is that you?"
Paul brings the conched hands to his ear, then says in a high-pitched voice,
"Yes, it's me, all right."
He lowers his hands again to address the ant.
"We've all been very worried about you, Roland. Where have you been?"
"I went away to see my aunt!"
"That's very funny, Roland, but next time let us know in advance, okay?"
"It's not him!"
Remington gurgles through incipient tears.
"It is him!"
Paul remonstrates.
"Of course it's him!"
"It's not!"
Klitzia chimes in.
"Whose side are you on?"
Paul says.
"It's not even an ant," she says exasperatedly. "It's a spider."
Paul examines the tiny creature crouched in his palm.
"So it is,"
he says. "Actually, it looks a little bit like your mother."
"My mother would cry bitter tears if she knew that I have shackled myself to a man who cannot even tell an ant from a spider,"
Klitzia attests.
"Let's try to think positively about this,"
Paul says.
"Remington,
How would you like a brand new pet spider?
From his wails, it is evident that Remington would not like this very much.
What if we pull a couple of his legs off? Bull says in an undertone to me.
Think that'd fool him? Wouldn't it be better just to find Roland?
Forget it, Bull says. That ain't his history.
Hearing this, Remington's howls double in volume. Clitia gazes from one of us to the other in utter disgust. Then, picking up her son,
"Come on, Remington, you help Mama dry her hair," she says and carries him still bawling to his bedroom.
The door slams behind her. Paul and I find ourselves in silence.
"So," I say.
"Yeah," Paul says.
"Well, look, thanks again for helping me with the search. I'll let you know if there are any new developments."
"You're welcome," I say. "But while I'm here, maybe we should have a quick discussion of the plan."
"The plan?"
"The plan you were devising for me and Ariadne."
"Oh, that,"
he says, face clouding. "We had arranged to talk about it tonight, if you remember."
Right, of course. I'll be perfectly honest, Claude. What with the whole Roland situation, this place has been kind of a madhouse."
"I do not follow. When did Roland escape?"
"About half an hour ago. But it's been brewing for a couple of days now."
"I see," I say, though this is not quite true. "So we are slightly behind schedule."
"Slightly,"
Paul says. "Well, perhaps we should review what we have so far."
"Yeah, you know, as an artist, I'm not entirely comfortable with showing work before it's ready. But rest assured, I'm making serious headway with your story."
"Ha!"
Clitia comments, sweeping out of the nursery like a svelte, ironical bushfire. "Pay no attention to my wife. I'm giving this my fullest attention."
"If you are paying him to look at whores on the computer, then I can confirm that he is giving it his full attention,"
Clitia says. She looks at the clock, swears, then clips off into the bathroom.
"Are you going somewhere?"
Paul asks. Clitia barks something fierce but unintelligible from the other room.
"What?"
he shouts back. She reappears in a tracksuit with a nylon sports bag on her shoulder.
"Volleyball tryouts."
Paul looks nonplussed.
"I have told you 20 times, Clitia says. "There is tryout tonight for volleyball team, Cleaners League."
"I don't remember you mentioning."
"That's because you don't listen to anything I say,"
she shouts back with surprising vehemence.
"Too busy wasting time with the idiot plants."
"It's not an idiot plan," he says. "Jesus, Clitia, you complain when I'm not working, then when I am working, you're standing around all the time making sarcastic remarks."
"Working, ha!"
she says, taking a hairbrush and furiously attacking her hair.
"Yes, working. We're not in Ectovia now. People have jobs other than peeling potatoes and digging mass graves."
A whimper emerges from Remington's room. She throws her arms up.
"I'm going to be late."
"I'll take care of him," Bull says. "Go to your tryout."
She stomps off without saying goodbye.
"Sorry about that," he says to me as the door slams shut. "She's been kind of tense lately.
She doesn't approve of our arrangement."
"She doesn't approve of much that I do, Claude. I wouldn't worry about it."
The nursery door opens and Remington pads out.
"Dad, can we play Rainbow Mystery Epic?"
"Aren't you supposed to be asleep?"
"Just for a minute. I'll be Peekaboo, number one rainbow collector. You'll be Purple Aqualing."
Okay.
"Now steal my rainbows."
"I'm going to steal your rainbows," Paul roars.
Remington shrieks and runs off behind the couch. His father turns to me warily.
"So anyhow, there's the progress report."
"I see."
I stroke my chin.
"Well, I imagine it takes a little while to find your way into a project. Let's meet again in a few days' time when you've had more time to think.
Why don't you come over to my apartment? We can have dinner and afterwards we will be able to talk undisturbed."
"That'd be great, Claude. I'll have everything locked down by then, I promise."
I suppose I should be disappointed, but as I let myself out, I am tingling with excitement. The symbolism of the redeemed writing desk seems to me incontrovertible. I make my way down the hall, lost in happy fantasies of rescuing his career and quite possibly his marriage. And then something calls me from them. It is so subtle that at first I can't tell what it is or even which sense has perceived it, but with every onward step it grows stronger. Perfume. The same heady scent that gilded the edges of the steam in the bathroom now dances languorously through the stale air of the hallway. On the landing, it becomes denser, more insistent, directing me to follow it down the stairwell. But then I notice something else. In the dust beneath the plastic sheeting that closes off the unfinished rooms are fresh footprints. Two different kinds. One set, trainers, going in. Another set, heels, going out. I push aside the plastic sheet, step onto bare planks. Everything is dark. Perfume pours from the doorless entrance to the right. I follow it, stepping through the frame into the shell of an apartment. The light of the city moon shines through the window to bleach the unsanded floorboards. In a corner lies the nylon sports bag. Inside it, the tracksuit, trainers, and the top that Klitsia wore when she left the apartment. I'm sure there is a perfectly reasonable explanation, but I can't think of it. Nor can I think why she would bathe or wash her hair or put on those scandalous knickers before a volleyball game. I stand by the window for what seems a long time, but the answers don't present themselves. There is only the opaque shimmer of the night and the city, and her perfume wrapping itself round and round me, purring like a cat.
Life is so loud that it takes a few moments to realize it is almost empty. Everyone is packed into one little corner where the BOT celebrations are in full swing.
"Rachel started a tab," Ish explains, pointing to where the chief operating officer stands deep in conversation with Howie. Outside the bank, she appears even more like a hologram, the digital reprise of something happening far, far away.
"If I was Howie, I wouldn't drink anything she'd bought me," Joe Piston says.
"Rachel doesn't see him as a threat," I say. "A deal like that makes everyone look good."
"I don't know, Claude," Gary McCrum says. "If Porter wants to keep him at BOT, he'd better come up with something pretty special. And Rachel had better hope it's not her head on a plate."
Word of Howie's spectacular coup has passed beyond BOT and into the greater financial world. Trading forums are alight with it, investment bloggers ballyhoo it. Howie's name bounces through time zones from one continent to the next. Many commentators see the trade as a vindication of Porter Blankley's controversial, counterintuitive approach. In an article entitled "Wrong About Wrong," Bloomberg praises Blankley's discounting of data and logic as a Copernican revolution in active credit management. Today saw a whole series of similarly counterintuitive positions around the world, traders betting against the market, common sense, their own best instincts.
"Such bullshit," Ish grumbles.
"What are you talking about?"
"The whole thing was a fluke. It's totally obvious."
"A fluke!"
Kevin squeaks.
"He solved the riddle, Ish."
"I don't think it even was a riddle," Ish says. "What do you think, Claude? Do you think Porter Blankley genuinely knew what was going to happen with this guy setting himself on fire? Or was it all one big coincidence?"
I shrug. "I know what we'll be telling the shareholders."
Jürgen appears with a fresh bottle of champagne. He tops up our glasses, then raises his own.
"Exciting times,"
he says.
"And more is on the way."
"Word is that Agron is happening," Joe Piston says to Jürgen.
"Agron is happening," I say.
"Agron is on,"
Jürgen confirms.
"What?"
he says.
"Barely here a month and already he's moving on Agron,"
Gary McCrum says. "Now that's a chief executive."
"Look, people keep saying Agron over and over and I have no idea what it means," Ish says.
That is unusual,
Jürgen says,
as the potential Agron bid has been mooted in the last two issues of Torabundo Times, the in-house bulletin that is printed out weekly for your personal consumption.
You read that thing, Ish says.
What do you do with it?
Jürgen says, I use it to line the parakeet's cage, Ish says.
Jürgen takes a tiny pad from his shirt pocket and makes a note. Agron is the Agronomical Bank of Wisconsin. It began life in the 1930s as a small savings and loan offering succor to farmers affected by the Dust Bowl. However, in the 1990s, it began a series of mergers and takeovers, beginning with U.S. investment bank Klaus Weintraub, then spreading its tentacles across both oceans to devour a Belgian commercial bank, a Swiss reinsurance firm, an Australian gold mine, as well as a host of other more esoteric investments. However, many of these acquisitions were not as robust as they had thought, I tell Ish. The gold mine is the subject of an enormous lawsuit for environmental damage. The Belgians have been hurt by the collapse of the national government, etc., etc. Agron does not have the reserves to ride out all of these disasters.
The body's looking for a white knight,
Jürgen says.
Porter believes he can convince the market to back us.
Wait a second. He says, let me get this straight. Agron was doing famously until it bought a whole load of dodgy banks and overextended itself, and now it's broke, right?
That's right.
And now Porter wants us to go and do exactly the same thing?
In a sense,
Jürgen says,
but BOT is in a very different position from Agron.
Wasn't Agron in a very different position from Agron before it bought all those dodgy banks?
That's what makes this deal so counterintuitive.
Jürgen says,
no one is doing insanely risky takeovers like this at the moment.
Can we raise that kind of capital? Joe asks.
That remains to be seen, but Porter is determined to expand one way or the other.
Jürgen pauses, weighing his words, and then says,
what I hear from New York is that Porter was very disappointed not to get the Caliph's sovereign wealth business, given his long-standing personal relationship with him.
Business is business, Gary McCrum says. Yeah, the guy's trying to put down an uprising after all, says Jewel.
This is exactly the point. The Tordale episode has made Porter realize that BOT does not yet carry sufficient weight to be a major force at the geopolitical level. It is still affected by global events instead of setting its own agenda reality-wise.
Reality-wise? Ish says,
a sufficiently large bank would create its own reality as opposed to simply reacting to consensus,
Jürgen explains.
What the?
Ish shrieks as the man of the hour seizes her from behind.
What the fuck, Howie?
I'm creating my own reality, Howie says. Can you feel it? Just there against your thigh.
You're a fucking child, Ish says, furiously swiping whiskey off her top. Congratulations on your trade, I tell him. Howie just shrugs.
I figure somebody in this operation ought to be making some money.
Clearing his throat, Jürgen remarks modestly that actually his team has made some money for the bank also, in that we have just submitted BOT's first ever government-commissioned report.
It does not compare to your trade, of course. Nevertheless, from what I hear, the ministry is very happy.
Maybe he'll put you in his will,
Howie says, then seeing our blank looks. Haven't you heard? He's dying. He's just come out.
We check our phones in case this is one of Howie's dubious jokes. It's not. The minister has been diagnosed with terminal cancer. Somehow a newspaper got hold of it and broke the news before he even had time to tell his family.
Fucking journalists, Joe says, shaking his head. Fucking vultures. It was bloody Royal Irish that did for him, Ish states. He turned the whole country inside out trying to keep it going, and himself with it, and for what? No investor's going to go near that place with a 10-foot pole.
I've got a 10-foot pole you might be interested in,
Howie says.
What is wrong with you?
Ish says. Howie just laughs and swaggers away.
Seriously, what's that guy's problem?
She asks.
He likes you, Kevin says.
Fuck off,
He does.
He does like you, Ish, I confirm.
Howie doesn't like anyone, Ish says. I'll bet he just wants an I for his creepy BOT6 alphabet.
I was his K,
Kimberly exclaims in passing.
Looks like you missed your chance, Kevin,
Joe Piston says,